Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today we're paying tribute to Philip Roth, and here's Liev Schreiber reading a passage from the 2006 novella, Everyman.
Religion was a lie that he had recognized early in life, and he found all religions offensive, considered their superstitious folderole meaningless, childish, couldn't stand the complete unadultness, the baby talk and the righteousness, and the sheep, the avid believers. No hocus-pocus about death and God or obsolete fantasies of heaven for him. There was only our bodies, born to live and die on terms decided by the bodies that had lived and died before us. If he could be said to have located a philosophical niche for himself, that was it. He'd come upon it early and intuitively, and however elemental, that was the whole of it. Should he ever write an autobiography, he'd call it The Life and Death of a Male Body.
After Roth died, the reaction was almost unanimous, a mourning of one of the most audacious and original voices in the history of American fiction. But he faced criticism throughout his career, too, criticism that got louder in recent years about the way that he wrote about women. I talked about this with three writers who knew Roth and his work quite well: Judith Thurman, a staff writer at The New Yorker, Lisa Halliday, a novelist, and his biographer, Claudia Roth Pierpont, who's no relation to Philip. And I asked them to weigh in on this extremely controversial aspect of his work. Judith, I want to begin with you meeting Philip Roth.
Okay.
And I think you met through the mail,
yes,
right? I mean, we have this picture of Philip as a writer who lived his life largely almost as in a kind of soldierly discipline in the country, alone much of the time, writing all the time, doesn't really care much about other writers. And yet what happened?
He cared very much, passionately, really, about other writers. I was a young biographer. I was in my early 30s, and my first book had just been published, biography of Isaac Dinesen. And one day, I opened, there was no, of course, email, and I went to the mail, and there was a letter, handwritten letter in it, and it was a fan letter from Philip Roth. And I thought it was my crazy friend Max.
Imitating
Philip Roth and telling me how great my work was. And I actually called Max, and he disavowed any knowledge of the letter. So I wrote back still suspiciously, if you were Philip Roth, the writer, not the candlestick maker, I'm very grateful for this letter. I said something more than really grateful. I was floored and elated to receive it. And so he said, let's meet. And so we met. It was 1983.
Claudia, you wrote a kind of critical biography. It's a mixed genre book, I would say. It's, mm-hmm. it's both biographical yeah. and critical. And my understanding is Philip Roth, like any number of other writers, was not exactly inviting to the biographical enterprise.
He was terrified of it. Yeah, he said there are two things to fear in life, death and biography.
Why did he fear biography so much?
I think because he read some of them and some of them about his friends.
In the 80s and the 90s, there were a series of sort of gotcha biographies of great writers. And he had a particular revulsion and fear of someone treating him as a case, or rather than going out to understand him, going out to get him.
Lisa, what do you think that Philip Roth felt were his weak points, that somebody would go at him, as it were? What was he defensive of?
Well, listening to Judith and Claudia, I've been thinking about how Philip really was about as famous as a writer could be. And I think a lot of people, when they meet someone like Philip, they want so badly to take away from it a story, an anecdote. And so everything he says, everything he does, every expression he makes means so much to someone who's meeting him for the first time, or even the second or third or fourth or tenth time. And I think he just became used to people taking away impressions that surprised him.
You've just published a novel, a remarkable novel, in which I think it's pretty apparent. You had a relationship with and a friendship with Philip Roth. And when I read the sections about that novelist, about that relationship, I can hear Philip Roth talking. The jokes, the sentences, the spring in the personality. So in a sense, you brought him into fiction. How did he react to that?
Well, he knew I was working on something for a long time, and maybe he was a little nervous, but he was also wonderful about it. I mean, no one knows better than Philip. No one knew better than Philip what it's like to write fiction. You use whatever you can. You do it however you can. I really did want to share with the reader some of what I loved about Philip, what I loved most about him. But all of that said, it is a novel. It's not a faithful account of our own story. Things that happened to me and to Philip do not happen in the book, and vice versa.
Lisa, I and I could ask this question to all of you, but you're the, as it were, the youngest person in the room. Philip Roth is my birthright. I grew up in New Jersey, a Jewish boy, a male of a certain age. I almost imagined if, you know, my father had not become a dentist, but rather had been a literary genius, he'd be Philip Roth. So there was no question that this was going to enter my bloodstream and shape my so much of me. I wonder how you, as somebody considerably younger, came to those books, which books, and what effect they had on you.
Well, the very first time I heard Philip's name was not until I was in college, and my Jewish boyfriend's mother told me that I had to read Portnoy's Complaint.
Let's pause over that for a moment. The boyfriend's mother wanted you to read Portnoy.
Yes.
There's a young woman who works here named Carla Blumenkranz who wrote about reading Portnoy as a young woman, as a 14 or 15-year-old, and she was thrilled by it, but it also scared the hell out of her, meaning this is what men think. This is what's running through their mind all the time. It was a scary book to them, Judith.
That's actually sort of touching to me because I always assumed that was what men thought. Maybe that's a generational divide.
And you think differently now?
No. Yeah. I don't. My mother was obsessed with Mrs. Roth. I think she was afraid that I was a writer from a very young age, that I would do a Portnoy, which was not in the stars for my family.
But Philip was very self-aware of this. He always quote, I forget who the quote is from.
Milos. A writer is born into a family, the family is finished.
There goes the family.
Yeah.
Did Philip feel a sense of, even though his mother was hardly Sophie Portnoy, and did he feel that he was consuming or even violating the people he knew and loved or even came to hate?
I think the Mrs. Portnoy thing haunted him for a long time. And I think he made amends, if you will, and in a very reverential way in The Plot Against America. The extreme overcautiousness that drives Portnoy crazy, when you get to Plot Against America, it becomes heroism because they are actually in a situation that these American Jews back in the 40s might have imagined themselves to be in, which their son thought was absurd because he was an American and nobody was coming after him. Now, Plot Against America, when you bring fascism to the United States, they are confronted with a situation where their cautiousness is a virtue. He creates a situation to elevate them, and while not changing who they were at all.
It should also be said that Philip really regretted Portnoy. He
regretted it?
Yes.
Even though it's the breakthrough?
He deeply regretted Portnoy. We talked about it a lot. It made him into a joke on late night television, the Jackal, the famous endlessly repeated Jacqueline Suzanne remark. It made it, Jacqueline Suzanne said something about...
it's on Johnny Carson.
On Johnny Carson, yeah. I wouldn't want to shake his hand.
And people would see him on the street.
People would see him on the street.
Make jokes about masturbation livers. And liver. And after the first 5,000 times, it was funny.
Right. He felt he completely lost his privacy. That's when he sort of fled to the country.
He tried to imagine what his life would have been like had he not written it.
Yes, often. Sure.
Us are talking about all of this is reminding me of how not so long ago Philip had recommended to me rereading Madame Bovary and also gave me a copy of a book that someone had recently sent to him, which is called The Perpetual Orgy. After he gave it to me, and in fact, after I brought it back to Milan, I noticed in the book that he had written on the back of the letter something that Flaubert once said, which is, the task at hand is not to change humanity, but to know it. And I just, when I saw that, I thought, you could apply that to every book of Philip's. Mm-hmm. Every complaint that anyone has ever made, it tends to be, well, he's a misogynist, or he's got it out for the Jews. And this is just not what he was doing. He wanted to know humanity and to reflect it, not to change it or make it into a moral project.
You raised the misogyny question, and I guess it's inevitable. Mm-hmm. In Harper's, Vivian Gornick wrote in 2008, in Portnoy's complaint, probably for the first time in Jewish American literature, by the way, a phrase that Philip would reject.
It was horrible, right.
Woman-hating is openly associated with a consuming anger at what it has meant to be pushed to the margin generation after generation, humiliated time and again into second-class lives. I think it's fair to say Vivian Gornick was not a fan.
No.
She at one point, she said, for Philip Roth, women are monstrous.
His work is full of female characters who mean something to me, to whom I am deeply attached, from Dranka to Amy Bellette. I mean, one could name them and name them and name them. What he doesn't do, and some more subtle or younger critics have blamed him for not having major female protagonists, for seeing the world through the eyes of a male figure who somewhat resembles Philip Roth, usually born in 1933. And I would say this about it, that all talents come with conditions. And I think his condition was to present the world through the eyes of someone who was not himself at all, but someone who took a stand somewhere similar on ground that he understood. And I see it as a kind of lighthouse in a way, if that's a bad simile. You set up your building, but on the top of that building is a flashing, radiating light. And that light, those eyes of that protagonist, whoever that protagonist might be, took in the world, men, women, children. I think there are as many fascinating and interesting female characters in his work as in anybody's work. They may not be the person who is presenting the story, but they are taken in and they are alive. The first book I ever fell in love with was The Ghostwriter. And there are two male characters and two female characters, and I think you'd be hard put to say who's the most fascinating person in that book.
Then where does this critique come from?
It comes from the perception of sexual predation, I think. I think it comes from...
On the page.
On the page, which is a confusion. Well, this is a very, very thorny subject in Me Too times. It's, in my view, it's a confusion of lust with misogyny. There's a certain kind of rampaging, voracious sexual appetite. And I don't think anybody can deny that Philip had that as a man. His characters certainly have that on the page. And that's not misogyny. It's a certain kind of a very intense desire.
Lisa, are there any books that you read of Philip's that you do pause over and think, this bit is making me uncomfortable and not in a good way?
No. I don't know. You asked where the issue comes from, and I've never really understood it myself. I think it comes from lust, but also awe. I mean, Philip was in awe of so many women, and I think that comes through in the books as well. His narrators are in awe of many of the female characters, and maybe occasionally that translates into a slight sense of fear on the part of the male character, the narrator. But I don't know how we get from there to misogyny. I don't understand it.
I think that there's something to be said about making an analogy between the early criticism that the Jews had of him and the criticism that some women have of him now. And that criticism was about presenting characters who are less than perfect. In the late 50s, his Jewish readers, who became so irate, said, how dare you present a Jewish adulterer? In other words, how dare you give them ammunition? And he came to understand that, although it didn't change his writing, because he felt literature was about presenting what is. It wouldn't be literature to present a world of perfect Jews with no character. He had nothing to write about. He was writing a book about people, and people have flaws, and his women have flaws. And somehow I think we're in a little bit of a position regarding him where it's considered wrong or hateful for him, maybe because he already has acquired the reputation he has, to look at women who are flawed. But everybody in his books is flawed.
I sometimes have a pause. It's a personal one, because Philip himself had a weakness for the fragile woman, the waifish woman, the woman who needed to be saved. And there are so many women, their characters are fascinating and interesting, but they are a little broken or very broken. Or I think that's something that gives someone like Vivian a pause, but it's not the only thing.
I want to talk about his prose. He was actually quite interesting when comparing himself to his people he thought were his peers. I was talking about Updike. He said, "I don't have the gush of prose," which he felt that Updike absolutely did. "I have the gush of invention, dialogue, event, but not of prose." Is he right about himself? What's the shape of the achievement of Philip Roth's book?
His achievement? Book after book after book. In my mind, we haven't had anybody like that. I mean, that covers such a range, over 50 years, continually reinventing himself. When people say, "What should I read?" you have to say, "Well, who are you? Where do you want to start?"
And although the later novels remain hyper-intimate, they've become large in a sense, and they become political. And Claudia, you've written that America and Philip Roth grew up together. And then along comes Donald Trump. Did Philip Roth die disappointed in America?
Yes, he did. He was. He said he had never been more terrified in his entire life, having lived through everything he lived through. Lindbergh, including Lindbergh, the Depression, the war, the 50s, the McCarthy hearings, Nixon, Watergate, all that. He was. I don't want to say despairing, but I don't think that
he was horrified.
He was beyond horrified. And in some ways, the degradation of language that Donald Trump represents was one of the most personally excruciating aspects of the Trump presidency. The Orwellian newspeak that we wake up every morning and tune into.
Lisa, Claudia, and Judith, we were all at Philip Roth's funeral, which was quite a small funeral in a small cemetery at Bard College. And what happened was people read passages from Philip's book. There was no Kaddish. There was no prayer at all. It was the most secular funeral I've ever attended, I think. All of you were much closer friends, but I always got the sense that Philip never expected to live even as long as he did. He died with 16 stents in his heart, any number of spinal problems, depression, all kinds of things that happened over the course of his middle age and older age. Death is all through these books. There's so many graveyard scenes. It's much more than in Shakespeare. How did he think about death toward the end, Lisa?
Well, actually, I think it was a couple of years ago. I was visiting him out in Connecticut, and he and another friend and I were watching a mini-series about John Adams. And at the end, John Adams dies. And the next morning, I was leaving, and of course, I was very sad. And he said, "Don't worry, I decided last night that I'm going to live a very long time." He said, "If John Adams can make it to 91... then so can I." And I'm a little angry with him for not keeping that promise.
I think that all this emphasis on death in the books shows exactly what he didn't want. I think he was very attached to life up until the end. And I think he was ready to go on. I don't think he was happily resigned to this until maybe the last couple of days when there was no other way out.
Was he scared?
I didn't see fear. I saw eventually a resignation. I saw a lot of tenderness for the people around him, telling us, "You have to let me go," knowing that I think he was afraid it was causing us more pain than it was him.
He lived, in terms of health, an almost monkish life, to prolong it as long as it could be prolonged. And when it couldn't be prolonged in such a way as to give him what he considered a real life, being able to swim, being able to walk, being able to move, being able to enjoy things, he was adamant about not going on. He pulled the plug on himself. He said, "I want to live or I want to die, but I'm not going to stay in the middle." And after that, he saw dying as the same kind of work that he had saw writing. And he said, at a certain point, he didn't want people around the bed anymore. He said, "I have work to do." And by that he meant, "I have the work of dying."
He was from the shore. It was sand and ocean, horizon and sky,
daytime and nighttime, the light, the dark, the tide, the stars, the boats, the sun, the mists, the gulls. There were the jetties, the piers, the boardwalk, the booming, silent, limitless sea. Where he grew up, they had the Atlantic. You could touch your toes where America began. They lived in a stucco bungalow, two short streets from the edge of America. The house, the porch, the screens, the icebox, the tub, the linoleum, the broom, the pantry, the ants, the sofa, the radio, the garage, the outside shower with the slatted wooden floor Morty had built and the drain that always clogged. In summer, the salty sea breeze and the dazzling light. In September, the hurricanes. In January, the storms. They had January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. And then January. And then again January. No end to the stockpile of Januaries, of Mays, of Marches. August, December, April. Name a month and they had it in spades. They'd had endlessness. He'd grown up on endlessness and his mother. In the beginning, they were the same thing.
Liev Schreiber, reading from Sabbath's Theater. And we heard before that from the writers Judah Thurman, Claudia Roth-Pierpont, and Lisa Halliday.